Okay, our next presenter is Dr. Alan Morse, who is from the Jewish Guild for the Blind. Is that right? Thank you. And he is going to be speaking about medical care cost of Medicare, Medicaid beneficiaries with vision loss.
Good morning. We have no disclosable relationships. Bruce Pianson, the actuary who worked with me on this, has asked me to be a little bit more precise. He has no relationships he wishes to disclose. He has many relationships. Those of you who have heard me talk before, this is part of a series of work that we've been working on now for about 10 years, and I'll point out some of the studies we're going to go back and redo. There is a much more complete discussion of this particular work that will appear in an upcoming issue of Ophthalmic Epi. I chose not to publish each stage of it separately because it would be redundant. We've merged several of the studies in that presentation. By way of background, you've heard a number of presenters this morning talk about the age curve and the prevalence. A comment on prevalence and vision impairment. One of the numbers that's been talked about in New York for a number of years, one of our colleagues, not my colleagues, but one of our competitors actually, proudly announced a number of years ago that one in six people have serious vision disorders. That number is not correct, and it's done a lot of damage, because in some of the work that I'm doing now with CMS, the first thing we have to do is overcome the burden of all these people that they think will need a service if they provide coverage. So it's very important that when you do work like this, the numbers are reasonably reliable and accurate, particularly because what we do, what we're interested in doing, is figuring out the impact of vision loss on healthcare utilization. One of the earlier speakers talked about the overall cost of visual impairment. Another speaker talked about the dollar cost of people with vision loss. What we're interested in is figuring out a little bit more nuanced presentation, and that's what's the impact of vision loss on healthcare, not vision care, healthcare. In a study that we did 10 years ago, we looked at vision loss in patients in New York, 2.6 million discharges, and we looked across DRGs to see if we could separate those patients with vision loss from those without vision loss and identify their relative length of stay. Now, to show you how old the data are, you can see that the length of stay over here, 11.4 days, would now be approximately half that. We're going to be redoing this study probably this coming year, the 10th anniversary of the original study. What was important in that study was that across DRGs, people with vision loss stayed an average of 2.4 days longer. That means a person with heart attack or COPD or hip replacement stayed in the hospital longer, and we're hypothesizing as a result of vision loss, because we couldn't come up with anything medical other than vision loss that accounted for the difference in length of stay. People say, well, how does vision loss affect hip replacement, for example? It affects it because the rehabilitation is delayed. Commonly after orthopedic surgery, for example, a person would initially get into rehab, often in the recovery room, and certainly by that night they're going to be on their feet and walking. Patients who are visually impaired are not allowed to do that. Literally, they're not allowed to do that. They are catheterized. They have indwelling catheters. The catheters get infected. They stay in longer. And most importantly, the rehabilitation is often delayed by a day or two. The earlier you begin rehabilitation, the quicker you get out and the more effective the rehabilitation. So vision loss affects hospitalization across conditions. As a comorbidity, it contributes to falls, fractures, restrictions of mobility. Bilateral vision loss is associated with mortality, and vision impairment is an independent predictor of increased mortality. These are not my findings. These are from a number of other studies. What that all leads to is the fact that the impact of vision loss on healthcare has been understudied, and we have significant gaps in understanding how vision loss affects delivery of healthcare, utilization of healthcare, and perhaps most importantly these days, the cost of healthcare. In work that we presented briefly last year, we looked at reimbursement in a particular cohort of patients. Cohort were people in a program called the Program of All-Inclusive Care for the Elderly. It's a national program, exists in most states. It provides comprehensive capitated rehabilitation care. Among PACE programs, we found 107 visually impaired people. And visually impaired in PACE was defined as cannot see at all or sees some light or shadows, but not obstacles in path. We looked at hierarchical condition category risk adjusters, which is the methodology that Medicare uses to weight severity of risk, which becomes a multiplier in reimbursement formula. And this is what we found. In the vision impaired population, the risk was up to 1.09, and it increases very sharply among the non-institutionalized. What that means is patients with vision loss in institutions don't incur significant risk. In fact, their risk is lower. Patients who are outside institutions of vision loss have, in fact, a significantly greater risk of incurring additional health care cost. Quantified, that comes out to about 13% increase in risk. This year, we took a similar slice of the population, but from a much larger database, the Medicare 5% sample. It's a very, very useful data set in looking across a broad spectrum of the aged population in the U.S. Individuals that were coded with vision loss diagnoses, and those are in the ICD-9 codes, the 369 series, 369.0 to 369.9, in 2003, we took only those who survived into 2004 because we needed a future year in order to be able to predict cost. If they didn't survive, they didn't incur cost, and we excluded them from the study. The predicted costs for the 2003 were then compared with the cost for 2004. And this is what we get, and this is the money slide for those of you who deal in health economics, so this is the really important thing that we're talking about today. Across HCC scores, and let's go back, there are about 15,000 DRGs, I'm sorry, ICD, 9 codes, compressed into 800-odd DRGs, compressed further into about 160 HCCs. The HCCs combine diagnoses to come up with the highest configuration of reimbursement. They were designed to protect against providers gaming the system. And it made a difference in the early days whether you were a patient with heart disease who also had cancer or a patient with cancer who also had heart disease. The HCCs take away that gaming and they figure out what the highest reimbursement will be, and that's what you get. So the lower the HCC score, the less health risk or risk of incurring healthcare cost, presumably. In the patients with the lowest scores down here, you see that the difference between the expected cost and the actual cost is most significant. The impact this is means for providers is that for the majority, if you go all the way through all the categories until you get to the very last column, the cost is going to be greater than the projected cost. What that means is that you will be under-reimbursed if you're a healthcare provider treating visually impaired patients across every single HCC category until you get to the very extreme. Now, we've spoken with MedPAC and with CMS about these data, and they both agree with us. They both agree that the findings are accurate. CMS was rather candid about it, and they said, yeah, so what? So visually impaired people get reimbursed less. Big deal. The big deal is that no one's looking at it. And healthcare institutions who are trying and struggling to find ways of surviving need to be able to understand who it is they're treating and what it is that's adding to the cost. If they don't understand vision loss is a separate risk factor for incurring cost, they're not going to do anything to address it. We're working in New York now with a number of providers to help them both identify patients with vision loss and to help their staff understand how to better deal with them so they can reduce their expected cost. Over the next couple of years, probably 4 or 5 years from now, we'll have sufficient data to be able to look at that cause and effect and see if, in fact, we've been able to be successful in reducing those anticipated costs. So what we find overall is that Medicare persistently and consistently underestimates cost and therefore revenue for patients with vision loss. This is not the reimbursement to the individual practitioner. It's institutional reimbursement we're talking about. I didn't make that clear before. It's not the doctor necessarily. It's the nursing home, the hospital, the setting in which the care is being provided. In the Medicare 5% sample, if we go back to that last thing, it's about 17% across the categories for every category except those with a score of 2 or greater. So what we find is that there's a decline in functional status which is greater in those whose functioning is limited by vision loss than other comorbidities. And the more recent the vision loss will result in greater ADL impairment and greater disparity between cost and revenue. So a person who has suddenly become visually impaired is less able to cope with the decline in ADLs. He's had less instruction. He's going to be more impaired as a patient in an inpatient setting, going to require more assistance, is going to be delayed more in the onset of rehabilitation, and is going to remain in the institution longer, incurring increased costs. So mobility and travel limitations may make medical visits and follow up more difficult, and this is something that we're beginning to track. I was intrigued in the earlier presentation by the geo-tracking. That's something we're just starting to understand how to use. But we are on the same subway line in New York as Columbia, and Columbia it's a few subway stops, I think about 4 or 5, 15 minutes, and we find that even that short distance, not the 6 miles that you were talking about earlier, but even that short distance is enough of an impediment for many patients to say they can't get from the outpatient clinic at Columbia down to our vision rehab program. Right? 15 minutes on the subway is too big an impediment. People with vision loss have trouble traveling. Healthcare staff, in addition, are unaccustomed to working with people with vision loss, and by helping to educate them more about methods and techniques, we think we can help reduce the cost. Rehabilitation services, as I've said repeatedly, are initiated much more slowly, and perhaps most importantly, discharge planners have absolutely no understanding of the needs of visually impaired patients on discharge and are very, very reticent to release them from the facility. We have a couple limitations. The definitions used by PACE, the definitions used by Medicare, and the definitions that all of us use may not be the same. It's something that's common in working with visually impaired patients. We need to get a better and more consistent data set of what low vision is, where that threshold is. Is it 20/40 or less? Is it 20/70 or less? Is legal blindness 20/200 or less than 20/100? Those are not the same things. Most importantly, from my perspective, is the absence of coding of vision loss in most patients. Doctors who are doing procedures other than eye procedures consistently fail to identify vision loss as a comorbidity. They do that because under the HTC methodology, there's no add for vision. So there's no gain for the hospital or the institution for vision. Therefore, they don't see any benefit to do it. The benefit is statistical. It's good for people like us, but it's not real good for the institution. It's added work for the doc, and they don't see any reason to do it. So therefore, the most severe limitation is the patients who were identified may be atypical. We don't know, for example, in New York, where we had about 5,000 patients identified with vision loss, we would have expected at the least 1%, which would have been 25,000. So we have a very great disparity between the numbers reported and the prevalence that we know exists in vision care. We think this is a great area for study. We think it needs a lot more work, and we're hopeful that we can encourage some of our colleagues to start looking at the economics of vision loss, not just in terms of optometry and ophthalmology, but across the healthcare spectrum. We need to find ways, all of us working together, to reduce healthcare costs. We're going to be insuring more of our population, hopefully. We're going to be finding ways to get more people access to health care. And unless we find ways to make that healthcare more economic, the burden of healthcare in this country is going to balloon to levels that we can't sustain. Already, in terms of GDP, it's more than double almost any other industrialized country. So be glad to entertain any questions. In New York.
Because of the coding. And I didn't get whether it was any of the four codes in the CMS 1500 or just the number one code in the CMS 1500. So that's a technical issue, of course. Among those people, did you find, were you able to isolate in what arena the costs were specifically higher? In other words, did you find it to be an orthopedics issue? Were they falling? Recurrent heart disease because they couldn't read their medications. Were you able to identify what was causing the dramatic increase in costs for those visions?
That's an absolutely phenomenal question. No, we didn't. Let me give you an anecdote, and I don't think you'd mind me telling this. Our governor of New York, is, as most of you probably know, is blind, and I've known him for a long, long time. Well, he's legally blind. He's way past low vision. He's legally blind. He really is. He doesn't have any blindness skills. He doesn't know mobility or anything like that. But he is legally blind. But in the vision field, legal is important. When he was single, and very much in his mind a stud. When he went in the hospital for a procedure, and I won't disclose the procedure, he didn't tell the nurses he was blind, and he was out of the hospital in 3 days. When he was married, went back for the same procedure, his wife made a big deal of talking to the nurses and saying, you know, you got to be careful, David is blind. They left his catheter in. They didn't let him get up and go to the bathroom. He got an infection and was in there 2 weeks. Your question is a great question. We don't know why. What we do know, what we think we know, is what we can do to help address it. We can start teaching the staff how to deal with somebody who's visually impaired. We can talk with the docs about pulling out the catheter quicker and getting the patients up on their feet the same as any other patient. We can talk to the discharge planners about the resources of the community. We can train home care workers about how to deal with visually impaired patients, et cetera, et cetera. Reasons for patients staying longer would be a fascinating study. Yes, Mark?
Alan, this under reimbursement, because of the methodology that Medicare uses, is it unique to Medicare as opposed to Medicaid patients?
Yes. The HCC methodology is unique to Medicare. And we use the Medicare because increasingly that's the slice. There are two populations that are going to be extraordinarily scrutinized, regardless of who wins the election on Tuesday. The Medicaid population, because the common perception is that the people are women who are black, and that's the population. That's absolutely wrong. It's a white population. The majority of people are kids and everything else, and the elderly, because they're increasing with such a great trajectory. So the way, and of course Medicare is of great concern because it's the way that most older people get their hospitalization covered, and that's a real factor. Hospital inpatient costs in this country have burgeoned at rates that are far in excess of any other country, and we need to find ways of controlling. So we focus specifically on Medicare. We also use Medicare because it's consistent across the 50 states. Medicaid, as you know, is state-specific. Some states cover benefits that other states exclude. So it would have been a much, much, much more difficult analysis going across each of the 50 states. Anything else? Thank you.